Session number 27340, Reel 1.
Right, Briggs, Reel 1. Thank you. Tell me where and when you were born, please.
I was born in Ecclesall in Bradford in 1925, the date being the 26th of January.
And what did your father do for a living?
Father, I don't know what he did earlier in life, but he worked in the textile department and he was manager of what is called, or what was called, the pattern room, where he was responsible for preparing patterns to send out to buyers, so far as I know.
What was Bradford like while you were growing up?
With the benefit of hindsight, it was dirty. Can you censor this? There's a saying, it was, all the buildings were black and all the people were white. That's sort of a gag that was spared. It was politically incorrect now. But the whole thing was different. We had a lot of, when I was young, we had trams going from Bradford down as far as Greengate, which was a distance of about 4 miles. And there was a railway bridge which these trams went underneath. And they had to have trams specially manufactured so that the trolleys would go under the bridge near Ecclesall railway station. Eventually, of course, the tram routes were dispensed with and they were taken over by trolley buses and motor buses. We in Ecclesall use a motor bus, although the district we call the village actually had the trolley buses service. And Bradford had many cinemas. The ones in the town centre were the New Victoria, the Ritz, the Odeon, the Theatre Royal. We had two theatres, the Alhambra, which is still there, and the Prince's Theatre, which is no longer there. Of the cinemas I mentioned, the building of the New Victoria, which was later called the Odeon, it accommodated, I think, 3,000 people. The building's still there, but there's nothing inside, and it's probably going to be pulled down and something put in its place. And there was a cinema in every location in Bradford, and the adverts for the cinema, or the cinemas, it covered probably 2.5 lengths in a old-fashioned newspaper. Do you want me to go on about what I did?
What did you enjoy when you were younger? What were your...
Well, the one thing I did enjoy, I became a drummer in a dance band. I took lessons from the drummer or percussionist in the Alhambra Orchestra. And prior to the war, I played in dance bands, which was my absolute joy. And I can still play, and if I'm sitting in a chair, I'm still playing the rhythm, so I get plenty of practice, but these days nobody asks me to play.
Where would you play? What areas would you play?
Well, we played out a lot at Yeadon Town Hall, which is about, 9 miles from Bradford. Played at Keighley Town Hall. Played at the Princess Hall in Bingley. The Victoria Hall in Saltaire. And we then got a permanent location because of the difficulty in travelling, because we all had to go in a big taxi, which during the week was used for funerals. And we eventually, play it permanently, or almost permanently, at a Catholic church, which was in a place, near a place called Five Lane Ends, where one of Morrison's big stores is now, called E5. And we played there for a considerable time. We were a resident band there. And it was called St. Francis Hall, known locally, affectionately, as Fanny's.
What type of... You say dance band music, but was there any influences that your band had? Who were your heroes in the musical world?
Oh, yes, indeed. All the big American bands, particularly. Particularly Artie Shaw, Tommy Dorsey, Jimmy Dorsey, Glenn Miller. I could probably go on, but I can't remember quick enough to continue the reminiscence. But there are still programmes on the radio which I listen to on Sunday night, Monday night. There's the old bands. My brother-in-law, he likes ironing, so he listens to the dance music of the 40s whilst he's ironing. So that's it.
Can I ask you about your education?
My education, I went to a local primary school which had two departments. It was called Hutton School, named after an industrial in Eccleshill and a philanthropist, I suppose. And he, I presume that he sort of left some money to the education department to sponsor, if that's the right word, Hutton School, where I went to as a young child, and I stayed there, I think, until I was about 7 or 8. And at that time, you then went on to a junior school, which was Wellington Road, both of them in Eccleshill. And I stayed there until I was 11. Then I went back to Hutton School, and then from Hutton School, I went to a commercial school, which was a private school in those days, but it was one of those situations whereby you went to a commercial school to sort of do shorthand typing, which was done by both boys and girls, effectively. Particularly in Bradford, there were certain companies who wouldn't employ girls. They'd employ a secretary, but as long as it were a boy. But that's how it was. But that didn't apply when I went to work.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I have a brother. He's 10 years older than me, so he's now in his 90th year. And he will be 19 in April. He served in the army, first of all with the Royal Artillery, and then he was transferred to the Royal Army Service Corps. He fought in North Africa and then Italy. And somewhere along the line he was awarded the mentioning dispatches.
Now, you mentioned a little bit about Bradford being a dirty place and being based in the textile industry. Can you give me a little bit of an idea how the town was affected, say, in the 1930s by the Depression? Was that a problem here?
It wasn't a problem personally, but to many people it was. But at that age, for some reason, it's taken for granted because you don't know any other. There's no other sort of... okay, so there's a difference between rich and poor, and big houses and small houses, but the people you know are out of work. You just take it for granted that they are out of work, and it's a fact of life, and it doesn't sort of... it doesn't really have any effect on you or them, from your point of view.
But were conditions bad in Bradford at that period of time?
I believe there were. I started working, I was nearly 16. The commercial school to which I went, you could sort of leave at any time. Well, you could anywhere after 14. And the reason I went there, really, was because my aunt was a principal at the girls' side of it, so it sort of followed that I would go. And in those days, although I did pass what was regarded, I think it was called in those days scholarship, which entitled you to go to grammar school, or, but my parents, perhaps wrongly, decided I should go this way because auntie was a principal. So that was that. And I left school. Can we go there now? I left school and went to work for Crofts Engineers at Thornbury in the office. And I worked there until I was called up.
So when did you start work? What year would you start to work?
I started work in 1939, just prior to the war. So I would have been 15 and a half, wouldn't I? That's right. Just prior to the war. And of course, the war came, and the fact is, of course, that you were then in the position to sort of, well, I shall be called up sooner or later, because I didn't want to be a draftsman. Draftsmen, by and large, were reserved occupation. But before I went into the Navy, I was put in a manager, if that's an overemphasised word, in charge of a small department relating to the rationing of iron and steel and filling forms in and returning them to the Ministry of this and that and other. And at that time I'd be about 17, 18. And because of that fact, I was, there is a term for it, deferred until I was 19 would be. I went in 1944, so obviously I was 19, wasn't I? Yeah, that's right, 19. So I was called up in June, was it? June 1944, that's right, yes.
Can I ask you a little bit about prior to the war breaking out? Had you any idea that the situation in Europe at that time?
Oh, yes. As I've said, I have a brother who was 10 years older than I was. And my father was very interested in politics of all sorts. He passed it on to his sons, and you know, we were quite well aware of Hitler. Not like some people. We were quite aware of Hitler and what he was doing, and of course, nobody wanted a war. This was the last thing that anybody wanted. And panic set in, and Joyce, who lived also in Ecclesill, who became my wife, obviously, she was... I've lost the word now. She went to a refuge... Not a refugee.
An evacuation.
Evacuation. She was evacuated to settle with the girls' drama school from Bradford, but hadn't met her at that time. It wasn't until she came back that I met her when she was 16 and I was 18.
Can you remember the outbreak of war at all, that Sunday morning?
Oh, yes. Yes, I can indeed. John, I was a friend with then, is still my friend, he was our best man. We went to Blackpool on a holiday. And the war broke out. We were sitting in the little sort of, we called a private hotel now in those days, it was called a boarding house. And the pair of us are sitting there listening to Neville Chamberlain in the sort of, wherever you sat down, I don't think it was exactly a lounge as such, you sort of went in for your meals, and there was a radio on in the corner, and we listened to Chamberlain giving his speech. And that was that. And both of us went in the Navy. Oh, there's a lot there. I'll go through them later.
How did you feel about the outbreak of war?
I suppose at that time, I thought, well, it can't last very long. somebody's going to win quite quickly, even if it goes 4 years. I was, at the time, I was 15. I thought there's no likelihood of me ever being called up at all. And, of course, I was wrong. But there it was.
You said you were employed at an engineering firm.
Yes.
Can you explain how the war changed what they were doing? Did it increase in war work?
It increased in war work in as much as it was a large organisation employing, I don't know, what is it? This is by, I think at one time, yes, there were manufacturers of power transmission machinery, it's all right, and used in every industry, wherever power is employed, be it hand, mechanical or electrical. The business was commenced by Sir Arthur Croft's father in 1887 and has been constantly been developing ever since, so much so that those works at that time, this was after the war, covered an area of more than 20 acres and employed over 2,000 people. At wartime, I would guess that they employed somewhere about 1,200 to 1,500.
Before the war, what had the machines been used for?
It was called power transmission appliances. Industrial gear units, industrial clutches, industrial couplings, shafting, everything that's not used now at all. Large gearboxes, which were used for transmitting power, not in relation, as most people interpret it, as electrical, but there was no electrical motors made. They were purchased from the electric motor manufacturers. And Croft's gearboxes were then driven by the motors, and the reduction gears effectively, and used in any industry at all, chemical, wool manufacturing, cotton manufacturing, and of course to raw ordnance factories up and down the country. But eventually Crofts had a new foundry built, and they were casting 500 pound bombs, only the cases of course, and then they went on presumably to be filled, and for some reason it had to have a separate name, but it was called Crofts Associated Industries. But it was primarily, I think, for the war.
And what was your initial employment again? What did you do when you first went to the
When I was 15, I was just an office boy, and then I went through what is called the order department, which prepared documentation for works manufacture, where each department within the works, do you want me to go into more detail? Each department in the works had a sort of a PS for pattern shop, IF for iron foundry, SF for steel foundry, BF for brass foundry, and it was called a route, and that was put on these sheets, which were done on an Ormig duplicator and distributed according to the route and according to the product. And of course, each product had a similar but identifiable route going through the manufacturer until it got to the. It was a process. It was the final process called giving in. And these, in those days, you had a language of your own, giving in. The chaps that did a particular job, they had a name which preceded the Christian name. the chap that looks after the V-ropes was called Rope Willie. And one of the chaps that drove a bogey around the factory, he was called Bogey Charlie. And that, it goes on, you know. You reminisce about these things and you forget all about them until a situation like this arises and they sort of come back.
You say you deferred, your call-up was deferred because you were doing a role within the factory.
That's right.
Can you tell me some more detail about what you were doing then?
Yes, well, what it was, we had to make a report. I'm going to flog in my memory a bit here. We had to fill in a report of how much iron we used and how much steel we used over a monthly period. And this information was obtained, I think, from the output of the iron foundry, the output of the steel foundry, and the output of the brass foundry. And they all had to be, each order that went through had to be assessed on how much iron and steel was going to be used, and how much, and then when it went out, how much iron and steel. So it was an inward and outward sort of return, which we sent, I think, to one of the ministries. I can't remember which one it was. It certainly wasn't aircraft production. I think it... Can you give me a clue of it?
Ministry of Supply,
I think. And we also had to give one on exports to... we even exported at that time. I wasn't aware of how we did it. That it was nothing to do with me at that time, and just simply, and we had to report to certain Pete Marwick and Mitchell, who were a very well known accountancy firm. They were secretaries for this, for one of them. And they submitted a sort of a joint. From all these various firms in the country, they then proceeded to notify, I don't know, was it Ministry of Export or something, about these figures. So really, it was, broadly speaking, it was relating to iron and steel. And I think this information, you got licences, which I didn't deal with, that you could have so much pig iron, so much, you know, we used to get scrap iron and sort of, they talk about recycling these days. There's a firm in Otley called G.W. Butler, and he used to go round, I don't mean he used to go, the firm used to go around and collect these iron filings and steel turnings, and then they were all ploughed back into the production of iron and steel. Whether that was included in what you could get, or whether this was additional to rationing, I don't know.
Could you tell me a little bit about your working day then, at that time while you were with Crofts?
At that time? I suppose I can. And... it's going to be a bit difficult for me to sort of identify before the war, or the early part, before I was called up, and afterwards, because I can show you this. This has come out by accident, really.
I mean, Susan, just give me a flavour for roughly what you're doing in a working day. Mm.
You see, that's... that's me there. That's just, I left home somewhere around 8 o'clock, as we started in the office at 8:30, and jumping over the time though to sort of dog's body office boy, I'll go on to something where just before I went into the Navy, by which time I was 19. Prior to that, I'd had a job in the order department, which necessitated preparing order papers so that manufacture could take place in the works. And one had to be taught how to write these, what we call preparations, out so that they all conform to one standard pattern. And he started in a small way with small orders that were in stock or nearly in stock, and Crofts had a name for them which was called guaranteed delivery orders. The red ones were supposed to be, this was going back to before the war, the system goes back to well before the war. Red guaranteed delivery orders, which were supposed to go out within 24 hours of being processed into the works, and the other ones were supposed to be within a guaranteed delivery period. When war came, of course, that was all kicked into touch because we were unable to guarantee. We were just working and working over, probably working over at nights, perhaps 3-4 nights, which we were paid tea money, which I think amounted to ninepence in old money. That we did, and we worked most Saturdays and sometimes on Sundays. I particularly remember working when we, after, during the war, I remember working the whole weekend and for about 3 weeks, so we went effectively about 21 days working every day, which the whole works did, and the works were on 24-hour days. Some of them sort of worked shifts of 8 hours, going all through the night, but that wasn't possible for certain departments. It was just impossible to carry out work during the overnight because it just didn't fit in with what was required. From working as, broadly speaking, an office junior, I got appointed to this job. Do I go over this again? Relating to the rationing of iron and steel, I had then a staff of only, I think, four. I think three girls and an office boy. And we were all part, it was a subdivision of the order department, and acted as a liaison of orders coming in and details of orders going out, and calculating the amount of iron and steel that was required in the manufacture, in the works. And that went on until such time I was called up into the Navy, having registered, I think, I registered when I was 17 and a half for national service. And I didn't realise at the time I was deferred. It was just not mentioned. And I just sat back waiting to be called up, and I didn't have it confirmed that I was deferred until I was presented in 1979 when the management, the public, the I think they have a different name now. The
personnel
manager did a report on all people that were getting a presentation for 40 years' service, And he pointed out at that time that I was in fact deferred for a period. Prior to that, I could only guess at it, and nobody told me it had happened.